kwakuwankwamnyako nauvuku naundukufu ata milele.
Broadcasting from high above the reserve, this is Radio Harambe. Jambo, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Radio Harambe, the companion podcast to our website, jamboeveryone.com. I am Dave McBride, broadcasting from the Radio Harambe studios. And joining me from somewhere in the world is a man who promises to never change his name just to sell some more plush dolls. It's Safari Mike. Mike, where are you today?
I am on the Cradle Mountain. Any idea where the Cradle Mountain is?
Cradle Mountain. Cradle Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
That's in English, cradle.
It's English, absolutely. It's not England, but it is an English word.
So I'm going to go with Australia.
Wow, pretty good, Dave. Tasmania.
Should have known it wasn't Australia.
Well, I mean, it's part of Australia.
I was going to say New Zealand and went to Australia because I knew I'd never heard of a Cradle Mountain in New Zealand.
I am studying the paddy melon. Do you know what a paddy melon is?
It's not a form of fruit, I assume.
It's not a form of fruit.
Do they have a patty melon salad now available at the vegetarian kiosk in Discovery Island?
No, they do not.
It sounds like a bird.
It looks like a wallaby and is related to the wallaby. Yeah. It is also called the rufous wallaby, but it's a little bit shorter and the tail is a little bit less hairy than a wallaby. Wow. They're kind of more short and stocky. Wow. And they are prevalent. The Tasmanian paddy melon, anyway, is prevalent in Tasmania. And the word paddy melon is derived from an Aboriginal word.
Wow, that's really cool. So it's a Tasmanian version of a wallaby.
Correct.
I never.
There are other kinds of paddy melons, but the Tasmanian one is probably the most numerous.
So it's indigenous to Tasmania.
Correct.
Wow, that's cool. You learn something new every day here on the Radio Harambe podcast, kids. That's why we get our connection all the way to Tasmania, so we can all learn these things. On today's show, Mike and I are going to discuss the news from Disney's Animal Kingdom, plus the rest of Walt Disney World. And then in our final segment, it's time to lock autopilot on homing signal and head back to the Cretaceous Age. But first, let's start with the local news. Actually, I'm going to start with a little bit of website podcast kind of news. First, I want to thank Dutch Lombrowski. And somebody whose name on iTunes, I really read this as Hate to Diz, I want to thank them both for leaving reviews this week on iTunes for us. For those who don't know, leaving reviews really does help sort of get us up in the rankings and allows more people to listen and kind of find the show a little easier. So thank you both. Thanks to everybody who's done that over the years. I guess it's almost years now to thank everybody for that. But and if you can, please do so. We ask that you do. Also, I want to remind folks that we still have some of our prized Warden Wilson's Air Rangers t-shirts still available. Go to jamboeveryone.com. Scroll down a bit. You'll see a picture of them there, and they'll tell you all about where to buy them. We still have a few left. They went pretty quick in the beginning, but we still have a few hanging around. So if you want one of those, and they are very, very cool, then I would suggest you do that. 100% of our profits from this go towards our conservation partners. We've already made a couple of donations for those shirts. We're going to make a few more. We're heading towards our goal here. I'm trying to get to about $500 before we start talking about how much we've actually made for conservation, but we're not too far off there just yet. So let's get to the news. First, there is a lot of construction going on all over the Animal Kingdom. Construction means new things, and Disney suits hope new things mean more people, and thus more cars. And with that in mind, construction has begun on a new parking lot called the Yeti Lot. It's basically an extension to the existing lot. And the new space is, Mike, I believe they're way in the back, like right when you're coming out of the gate, coming out of the where you pay for parking and start coming around, you'll see them all the way back there. This is kind of
it'll be used. I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
This is kind of hopeful thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it'll only be used, like I was going to say, in the most crowded of times. I mean, it's farther away, so it'll probably be the last resort. I don't know that for a fact, but that would be my suspicion. It is farther away than the parking lots now. But I guess as they increase capacity by adding Avatar Land at some point in time, they hope, I guess, they'll need the more parking space.
And I'm just glad they didn't incite any riots and call it the Dragon Lot. That would have been worse.
Well, what I want to know is if the lighting fixtures in the Yeti lot will blink like disco lights. That's what I want to know.
That's very possible. Very, very possible. All right, on to the next story. This is actually kind of an old story. I'll admit to you, trying to report news on a blog when you are on vacation tends to mean you're going to miss a few things. And this is one that I missed. This goes back a couple of weeks, but I wanted to mention it here because I think it deserves a mention. The Wild by Design guided walking tour is scheduled to be discontinued as of September 26th of this year. Really, I'm not shocked by this, Mike. I mean, the tour always seemed to be kind of sparsely attended, at least over the last couple of years. I went on the tour once. There was only maybe two other people besides myself and my wife. But I am kind of sad by it because I think the Wild by Design is a great tour, and I really would recommend this to anyone who's a fan of Imagineering, of Disney design, of Disney backstories, all these things, really an Animal Kingdom fan. If you're going to be in the park before September 26th, it's a short tour. It's a fun tour. I really would suggest that you do it because it's going to be missed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it points out sort of some of the details that we tend to talk about here on our show and on the podcast, but they do it as you're walking around the park, which I think brings it to life even a little bit more. Yeah, it's a great tour. I'm not surprised that it's going by the side. I mean, it's not, it's not the kind of thing that would be very popular. Of course, it doesn't really cost Disney all that much to run it, so I'm not sure why, but maybe they'll change it, do something different. I mean, who knows?
We can only hope. I mean, hopefully they'll do something involved in their design. I'm not so sure they will. These things usually go away for good. Mm-hmm. But it was a great tour. Mike and I actually discussed the possibility of doing, as our feature today, a review of the Wild by Design, which I took about a year ago, maybe slightly less than a year ago. Actually, slightly more than a year ago. I'm thinking of the backstage safari I did last year. But I did take it, and we were going to think about doing it. But I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, if we review the tour, basically we're just going to give away all of the design elements that we use for all of the other features, presentations that we do, like the one we're going to do today. So, you know, and because that's really all it is. So if you want to learn about, you know, if you want to open your eyes to the things that Mike constantly talks about, I mean, you know, he talks about the details in Harambe and the details in Dino Land and stuff. This is what Wild by Design does. And it's not just things like, oh, look, there's this many leaves on the Tree of Life. And it's mostly about these little kind of detail oriented things. And, you know, going into the stores and seeing the sculptures in the store and how all the themes come together and stuff like that. And it's fascinating, and it's going to be missed. And if you are going to be there before September 26th, I do recommend you do it if you haven't done it before. But on to the next, and this is one for the Bloody Mary drinkers out there. If you enjoy yourself a nice Bloody Mary in the morning, or really any time of day for that matter, you'll be happy to know that according to OrlandoParkNews.com, the Dawa Bar in Africa now offers some new Bloody Mary recipes, including, amongst a couple others, an African Bloody Mary that's made with African spices and garnished with homemade jerk beef. How about that? There's a couple others as well.
There's an Asian one I know that has it's garnished with a shrimp.
Yeah, there's a couple of others. The reason why I'm saying Orlando Park News is doing it, and we've gotten confirmation that this is it, I just haven't heard whether or not this is permanent. Disney has not changed this on their menus that they offer online. So, because you can go online and basically look at almost every menu now at Disney World, and they haven't reflected these in the new on their website yet. So, I don't know if this is just a test balloon for the summer or what. We haven't heard otherwise, right, Mike?
I have not heard. All I know is that it's out now, and who knows how long it'll be. But you know, some things stick, some things don't. The test run of Dole Whips at Tamu Tamu was just a test run for a week, and it's still going. So I guess we'll see how popular they are. I mean, there are four of them. Maybe not all four will be, you know, popular, and you know they'll stick to one signature one. Who knows? But yeah, there's no real knowledge as to how long they're going to stay. And heck, by the time this podcast comes out, maybe it'll be gone.
Who knows?
But hopefully they'll still be there when we are down there in a couple of weeks, because I'm going to try them, or try one or two of them anyway.
The Dawa Bar opens at a very civilized 9 a.m., folks. So if you are stumbling through the parks at 9 a.m. looking for a little bit of the hair of the dog, as they say, I know we've all been there, I can't believe the Dawa Bar opens at 9 a.m.
Bloody Marys are the appropriate drink for a 10 o'clock drink. That and mimosas.
I would agree 100%.
Nobody will look at you funny like you would if they were walking around with a glass of wine at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
But a Bloody Mary, that's okay.
On to the next story. The Disney's Animal Kingdom is going to celebrate Primate Day this coming Tuesday, August 5th. If you're listening to this beforehand, it is one of these events they do at Rafiki's Planet Watch. We mentioned just about all of these. They're mostly for kids, but I would suggest really anybody in the park to go and check it out. They're usually kind of some great information there, and a lot of adult information too, and a lot of sort of people hanging around answering questions. Considering the park's gorilla habitat is like one of the best in the country, It really is kind of altogether fitting that the Animal Kingdom would set aside a day for these, you know, endangered and majestic animals. But let me say this before I throw it over to you, Mike. Here is a great way to celebrate Primate Day from the comfort of your own home. Go to JohnBoEveryone.com, hit the conservation button, find the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund website, and make a donation. But this is one of those things we always talk about. We love these things. They're all kind of the same, but you know, I always wonder how they pick these things.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they pick them either. I know, for example, just this past week was Big Cat Day,
right?
And a friend of the show, Kyle Hitchcock, was there and took some pictures. And there, you know, I retweeted him and all that kind of stuff. And I think Gorilla Day will probably be similar. There'll be a couple of tables with probably skulls of gorillas and, bones and, you know, maybe some of the things that they, you know, confiscate from poachers, like the, you know, hands that they use for ashtrays and all that other disgusting stuff and pictures and, you know, information about conservation and how endangered they are and that kind of stuff. So it's a little thing that you maybe spend 15 minutes looking through or whatnot, but just get a little sense of what's going on with gorillas. And I guess in this will probably cover all primates.
Yeah.
Not just gorillas, although gorillas are, of course, the one great ape at the Animal Kingdom.
And there are a number of other primates at the Animal Kingdom as well. I mean, you can start naming them off. I mean, there's
lemurs, tamarins, gibbons, simiangs, the whole thing.
There's a whole bunch of them. So it's really kind of a cool little way to celebrate the primates. And while we mention an event celebrated at Disney's Animal Kingdom, I would also like to mention one not recognized in the park, just sort of a conservation story here. This past Thursday, July 31st, which is actually tomorrow when Mike and I are recording, but it'll be in the past when you hear it, It was actually recognized in the conservation community as World Ranger Day, which celebrates park rangers killed or injured in the line of duty. In the U.S., I think we have a very different idea of what a park ranger is. We think of sort of nice, smiling folks at our national parks giving guided tours and helping with information and that sort of thing. But in many, many places, especially in Africa, park rangers are literally frontline soldiers, in a war to save animals. And these folks risk their lives every day to stop poachers. And, you know, I just kind of wanted to take a second to recognize them and salute them and especially those hurt and killed in the line.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much to add to that. That's true. Africa is front and center. I mean, some of those countries like Kenya and Nigeria, they arm their rangers to stop poachers, and they poachers are as well armed or better armed than they are. And, there's firefights, and every year a number of rangers die in the line of duty.
If you follow these things online, it seems like there's one every week. I mean, there's just so many of them that like you said, are casualties of war, so to speak. That's it for the local news. When we come back, we're going to hand the show over to Safari Mike, who will bring us the world news. Hopefully we can keep Frozen off today's docket, but I'm not sure we can. So stay tuned.
Come on, gang. Let's take it home.
if you're like me, you're an Animal Kingdom fan who is just a bit tired of listening to so-called Disney experts who criticize our beloved park for being a, quote, half-day park. Well, it's time to put your frustrations into action by going to the Jumbo Everyone store at Zazzle.com/JumboEveryone and picking up one of our exclusive new Not a Half-Day Park t-shirts. They look great, and we will donate 50% of the profits to our conservation partners. The rest of it will go to helping keep Radio Harambe on the air and JumboEveryone.com on the web. Wear it the next time you visit the parks, or even better, the next time you attend a Disney fan meetup. Go to Zazzle.com/JumboEveryone today and wear your Animal Kingdom pride for all to see. And welcome back to Radio Harambe. It is time to head back to Tasmania to Safari Mike. He has the world news for us. Mike, what is in the news this week?
Well, today, Dave, we're going to go to Polynesia as well as Liberty Square. But first, Main Street USA and Cinderella's Castle and whatnot, and discuss the Move It, Shake It, Celebrate It parade, which I know you are a big fan of. It's getting a makeover. As you know, it's sort of a street party that goes on at the Magic Kingdom. Some of the characters that are there, like the Mad Hatter and Sebastian, are making their way out. Other characters like Stitch apparently are coming in. They should be ready to rock and roll in October. They've even saying that there's going to be new music, which, considering I couldn't tell you what the music was from the Move It, Shake It, Celebrate It parade currently, I guess it can only be a good thing. I am not the biggest fan of this parade. I think it's just sort of it's not the Festival of Fantasy. It just sort of clogs up the pathways around Main Street and Cinderella's Castle.
Exactly.
But it's going to continue to plow its way through, and it's going to get a makeover.
Do you remember when everything used to have Stitch?
Stitch was big for a while, yeah.
Ubiquitous. I mean, everywhere you went, you had Stitch. Now it's those Frozen people. But you used to have them everywhere. So when you said Stitch coming back into this, I was sort of surprised. I was like, wow, really? We're still doing Stitch, you know?
Well, he's still Ohana's. He still has the thing in Tomorrowland.
But it used to be anything. If they added a tweak to a parade or a little dance party or something, it always had Stitch. You know, Stitch ended up on the monorail spiel for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, I think Disney really thought Stitch was going to last a long time and sort of be a core character. And it just, he kind of faded.
Anyway, I'm getting off topic. Hopefully the Move It, Shake It, Celebrate It will improve. What's next?
Let's go to the Polynesian, Dave. The pool, the volcano pool, the iconic pool of the Polynesian has closed, and it's going to be closed for quite some time. It's not opening again until 2015 during the spring, I believe. While what you need to know if you're staying there, and first of all, if you're staying there, can I please borrow some money because you obviously got a lot of it? You are getting
and aren't well informed about the state of the resort
if you're spending $500 a night to stay at the Polynesian with all these construction issues and the lobby's boarded up and now the pool's closed, and I don't get it, but anyway, if you are staying at the Polynesian, you will get complimentary passes to Blizzard Beach while the pool is closed. Originally we had heard that it was going to be one day pass to Blizzard Beach, but that's actually not true. You can come and go as you like as long as you're staying at the Polynesian. The Blizzard Beach will have a area set up at the front of it where that will be, there for intaking people from the Polynesian. Use your Magic Band. You can go right on in. The buses will be picking you up from the Polynesian, bringing you right there to and from. There'll be plenty of busing. So they're really going out of their way to try to get you, to make up for the fact that the pool is closing. I'm curious as to how many people actually go through the through the process of getting on the bus, going to Blizzard Beach, just for a, you know, a half hour dip in the pool. That's what the resort pool was for. You know, you took a break during the day or whatever, jumped in the pool, at least for me, jumped in the pool for a half hour or so, relaxed a little bit. By making you go to Blizzard Beach, that really takes that out of the loop. I mean, then you have to sort of build your, you know, it's not a half hour process, no matter how easy they make it for you.
Right.
So anyway, they are trying. They're giving you, as long as you want, Blizzard Beach passes. You can come and go as you please, just like it was the resort pool. But they're doing that in the Polynesian. It started just the other day, and it will continue until the spring of 2015.
It's the least they can do when one considers the amount of money they're spending, you know, when staying at the Polynesian.
Oh, sure.
Now,
sure.
Mike, in the wintertime, one of each of the water parks closes. I would assume then when Blizzard Beach closes, Typhoon Lagoon would be the one for them?
They have not said anything of the sort.
Also, the other question I have is, if you do want a half-hour dip in the pool, can you board the monorail to one of the other monorail resorts and use their pool?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't either. So
you mean, so if you're at the Polynesian, could you just get on the resort resort loop and jump into the Grand Floridian pool?
Sure. I mean, you could walk there if you were intrepid enough. You know, it's
I guess you could.
It's not that long walk. I believe there's a pathway that leads you all the way to it.
Yeah, it's not that bad.
Yeah, I would hope that that offer is extended for the.
What stops people from doing that now?
Well, nothing really. I mean, all I know.
To.
Right, you're not supposed to, and in other resorts, they tell you you're not supposed to, and certainly in some resorts, and I'm thinking specifically of the Yacht and Beach Club, where they will like take your room key, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they do that at the Grand Floridian just to keep people from coming into it. I don't know.
I doubt it.
I haven't been there in years, certainly not to the pool. So I'm just curious if they tell people, you know, in the meantime, you can go over here as well as go to Blizzard Beach. Because like you said, that's a whole day going to Blizzard Beach. Nobody's going down there for an hour and a half.
Right. I mean, if they make it easy enough, how long of a bus drive is it? 20 minutes? I mean, this bus is dedicated to just picking you up at one spot in the Polynesian and bringing you to the front gate of the Blizzard Beach.
Yeah, and they also have, like, you know, sort of guest services vans that might be at the ready for whenever you walk up and take you there. I mean, they could have something like that as well. I know they do that, you know, if you go down to Kidani Village Lobby and say, I want to go to Jumbo House, they stick you in a van and off you go.
Right.
So, yeah, it could be. It'll be interesting to see how this works out. I hate talking about the Polynesian because it's breaking my heart. It really is. I hope they come out with a great resort at the end. I really don't have any confidence that they will, because I think that the original guys designed a great resort and there really wasn't much need to change it, maybe update it a bit. But, you know, such is life. What's next?
Moving forward, Dave. Mm-hmm. Time marches on.
I guess it does. And you know, Mike, I mean, okay, I get a lot of flack for complaining about all the changes that have been made, and I'm going to make a lot of complaints about this as the rest of the show goes on. If we were making the kind of changes that I think were actually enhancements, you know, and not, you know, the word plus doesn't really seem to be a plus to me in many situations. You know, we can name the dozens of things over the years that they've changed or remodeled, and they haven't done really well. Certainly haven't made any better. The Polynesian was an incredible, iconic resort that a lot of people just loved, that they remembered from their years. You know, it was something connected to Walt. I just hope it maintains that spirit. Maybe it's just the pessimist in me that says they won't. I'm gonna wait to see.
With everything else, there'll probably be some good and there'll be some bad.
Yeah.
Trader Sam's is going to be there, so that's good.
Yeah, except you probably won't be able to get in it.
Well, we'll see, I guess.
Right? And it'll be expensive.
Well, everything's expensive. Well, yeah. What's not expensive?
Well, that's true. Everything's expensive there. But you probably won't be able to get in it. So, whatever. Go ahead. Move along. I didn't want to get us off on that tangent again.
Speaking of expensive...
Oh, good.
Let's go to the Food and Wine Festival.
Mike's favorite.
Oh, God, I hate this damn thing. It's just ridiculous price. But anyway, it starts on September 19th. which seems earlier to me than it has been. They might have moved the date up a little bit. Ending on November 10th, and they just announced all of the menus. The one thing I noticed that there seems to be less vegetarian items for whatever reason. One of my favorite things, the spinach paneer pocket from the Africa booth, is now gone for some ungodly reason. It was one of the few decently priced, you know, good bargains. Maybe that's why it's gone, because it was actually not a ripoff.
Rather than making money.
A couple of new booths. There's a Farm Fresh booth, which has some gluten-free things in it for if you have that particular issue. Argentina has been replaced by Patagonia, which means nothing because Argentina and Patagonia, you know, Patagonia is part of Argentina, so I'm not sure what difference does it make. We still have an empanadas and, you know, whatever. But other than that, it's pretty similar. It is. Yeah, I don't know why they changed the name of it. It just to go from Argentina to Patagonia. I mean, I understand Patagonia encompasses the southern ends of Chile and Argentina, but I mean, who is making that determination? I don't know why. Seems like a waste of a sign. I mean, why waste the money on changing the sign?
Who knows?
But anyway, if you're interested in looking at all the various menus, if you're going down there for that time, make sure you bring a lot of money and go check out you know, one of the numerous websites that'll have all the menus out there for you, but it is out.
I must give my credit where credit is due. A lot of people over the last couple of years have been starting to sort of dial back the jubilation when it comes to the Food and Wine Festival. We must all admit, when it first started, for the first few years, people just went gaga over it. And Mike was like one of the first ones. Like, I think the first time you ever went there, your thought was, well, this is really expensive.
It's crazy,
you know, and so he's not new to this complaint. He's been with it for a long, long time. The one thing I'll say about it, I do enjoy it to a certain extent. Mike and I've talked about this a million times. It gets crazy crowded there. It gets nutty with people, especially on the weekends. I mean, the drunks walking around the place is crazy. But the biggest complaint for me now, and the reason why I probably wouldn't do it anytime soon, certainly, and maybe never again, is because of what Mike could have glossed over there real quickly, which is every year it's mostly the same. And for a food and wine festival, a festival, you don't want the same. You know, you want some sort of something new, different booths, different countries, different selections in those countries. I mean, you know, what they're doing now is what they do with everything. This is the money makers. We like the way these look, and you know, who cares about the people who come back every year? They're going to do it anyway, so they can get drunk and stumble around the World Showcase. But that's why I won't go anymore, because it's the last couple of times I've been there, it's been really exactly the same, and it's just, you know, what's the point of putting yourself through standing on these lines and navigating big crowds and World Showcase when you're just getting the same stuff you got last year and it really wasn't all that good to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why you would go to Epcot just to walk around World Showcase. To me, it ruins World Showcase.
Oh, totally. Totally.
And to spend $4 on a third of a hot dog just because it says, you know, Asian coleslaw on it.
Exactly.
It just seems, I mean, it's fine. It tastes just fine, whatever. But, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, some of the stuff, don't get me wrong, some of the stuff's really good. The lamb meatball in the New Zealand area, the hot dogs, not the hot dogs, excuse me, the pretzels in Germany. There's a good selection of beer at various different, I mean, they have a big craft beer booth, for example. So, you know, all that's fine.
Right.
But just sort of, I mean, it's all the same, and it ruins Epcot.
The beer remains, or at least last year, remains a not-so-bad value, because you can get different, at least the last time, in the tap places where you're getting, we're getting draft, you can get different sizes of beer. So you can buy a beer for $6 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, $6 is crazy, but it's not as crazy as it is in other places. But the story I always tell about this is, the first year I went, and I was there with my wife, you know, you went to Canada and you ordered the cheese soup. We had, you know, hadn't been in Le Cellier yet, is what got us into Le Cellier, because this cup of cheese soup was great. And we wanted to try it. We really liked it, right? But then last year when we were there, they gave you the same cup that they gave you the time before. However, it was half full.
Mm-hmm.
When they used to fill the cup with the soup. Now they charge you $2 more than they did whatever first time we went, you know, however many years ago, and they give you half the soup. I mean, there's only so much of that you could take before you've had enough, you know?
Mm.
That's just the way I am about it.
I'm over Canada. Not the country, but the whole pavilion. I'm over it.
No, I continue to like it, and I certainly like the movie.
Really? What do you like about the Canadian pavilion?
Canada makes good beer, better than good beer.
Do they sell good beer in the Canada pavilion? Forget World Showcase.
Yes, they do.
Food and wine.
They do. Yeah, there's a there is a beer tent kind of thing, cart, just on the exit of Le Cellier, the entrance and exit, the archway. Right. There's one right to the left there. And, they do sell it. So I do tend to stop there. I am not a subscriber to this theory that you've adopted to that somehow Off-Kilter is terrible. They are not terrible. They are a fantastic band.
That's awful.
You may not like their selections of songs or whatever you think it is.
It's not that. It's not even so much the selections of song. It's the fact that they intrude on the rest of World Showcase. I can hear them as walking around, you know, whatever, Norway. And it's just not Canadian. I mean,
It doesn't matter to me. It's not Canadian, but it's good. I prefer
good. Put them
good.
In downtown Disney. Put them in Disney Springs. They don't need to be there in Epcot.
Yeah, they do, because they're good, and people love them, and people flock to it.
People flock to Food and Wine, too. They're wrong.
Yes, they do, but they're not wrong about that. They're not wrong about Off-Kilter. Off-Kilter is good. They are a terrific band, if you are passing by there, stop and listen to them. Yes, if you're walking around, you can hear them in the background in the middle of the day, and oh, boy, that's so terrible.
You
could also hear the drums playing at noon or whatever it is when the color guard comes out in the colonial outfits. You can also hear that from all of
them.
You can also hear
the
drums
playing
in Japan from across the thing when I'm trying to enjoy my mariachi music. You can hear that. So there's a lot of intrusions audio-wise around World Showcase. So I don't accept that. I don't accept that as the reason why they're bad. But let's not get caught on Off-Kilter. Canada's not my favorite pavilion, but
the worst.
It's no by no means the worst. But
it's so far. What is worse than in terms of a
do
pavilion
we really have
Canada?
To do this?
Yeah, let's do it. I want to do it. What's worse than that? It has no counter service, so you know there's no place to just get your stupid cheese soup on a line somewhere. Le Cellier is so overpriced, it's ridiculous.
Right.
The movie is terrible.
The movie is not terrible.
It's terrible. The shops are up on a hill. You have to climb these steps to go see shops which have nothing in it. I mean, why is there no counter service? Why is there no brew pub? Why is there no anything like that? It's horrible. Put a Tim Hortons in there. Give me something.
Yeah, I agree with you. You could definitely make it better, but I can say that about almost every pavilion now.
There's one pavilion that's worse than that.
Italy's getting pretty close.
At least it has good food.
It has good food. Le Cellier's food was pretty good too, Mike. And people go crazy for it.
Overpriced.
I understand it's overpriced, but it's probably the most popular one in the World Showcase.
It's only popular because you can only fit like four people in the restaurant.
That's not true at all. But
it is true.
It's incredibly popular. I think that Canada is on par with a lot of other ones. I think that there's some good ones, but then you got ones like China and like Mexico and like Canada that don't have the signature thing. That yeah, they got to fix that for sure.
What's wrong with Mexico?
Can we move on, please?
It's a great inside, great atmosphere. I like the ride. It has La Cava del Tequila by itself makes it better than Canada.
I don't like tequila.
Oh, God. All right. Do you want to move on?
Yes!
I have a headache now. Let's go to Liberty Square, Dave.
Okay.
The oft-rumored, or long-rumored, I should say, conversion of the Yankee Trader Shop to a Haunted Mansion dedicated store has been confirmed by Disney. Sometime this fall, and the Yankee Trader should probably, by the time you're hearing this, is down for refurbishment. And when it opens sometime in the fall, it'll be dedicated exclusively as a Haunted Mansion shop. Personally, I think it's terrific that they're doing something like this. I think there should be more ride-specific merchandise. Haunted Mansion is a great one to do it at. I just hope they do it to to some other things like, well, whatever. But,
Yeah. I mean, having a ride specific shop is the first step. You have to fill it with really good ride specific merchandise, like what used to be at Pirates of the Caribbean,
right?
Or things like that, you know.
Therein lies a bit of the problem. If you look at the Disney Park blogs, about a week before they announced the Haunted Mansion gift shop coming, they did like release a plethora of Haunted Mansion specific merchandise, which, I mean, everybody probably could have guessed that they were going to have to build a store. I mean, if they're going to have like 40 different items of Haunted Mansion, they're going to have to do it, sell it somewhere. I'm not a big fan of what they put on the parks blog. I thought it was kind of meh. There wasn't really anything that was striking me as the t-shirts they had were kind of stupid. And some of the home goods kind of stuff was kind of cool. But hopefully it's better than what I saw, the sort of examples of stuff that you saw on the Disney Parks blog.
Yeah.
But I do applaud the effort anyway, and hopefully there'll be some more stuff. I mean, how great would it be to have a Kilimanjaro Safari specific store? Exactly. Or, well, you know, Bombasa's a little bit like that, but not really. You know, stuff like that. Some of the, you know, more iconic attractions, a Jungle Cruise store or, you know, whatever. Hopefully we'll get more of that. Hopefully this does well. Hopefully, and obviously the Haunted Mansion is very popular with this kind of stuff. So it's coming this fall.
Definitely. I mean, I agree with you. I saw the stuff that the Disney Parks blog put out, and I thought it was kind of, you know, certainly nothing I would run out to buy, for sure. But, you know, I'm just glad it's not a Frozen store.
Well, you know that's coming.
This is what I was half expecting it to be. But you're right. And I think all of us, you know, those of us who've been following the company for 30-plus years like we have, we all know one of the things that all of us sort of lament are the days when Disney Parks really did have some great, unique items for, you know, just for not just in park-related, but from all over the place. But they used to have some great park stuff. People always harken back to when Pirates of the Caribbean store was really just a great store with pirate stuff in that name. Mm-hmm. And there was a period there where we kind of, you know, made everything look the same and everything. So all the stores sold the same. And I'm just kind of hoping that with this co-op, with that opening this store, maybe Disney's kind of recognizing that, you know, people are sick of the same t-shirts everywhere mm-hmm. they go. And maybe they could sell things by offering something unique and being a little more creative with their merchandise like they used to be. So
I'm just sick of the, you know, Disney Parks 2011 t-shirts or whatever it was.
I mean, it's okay to buy them, but they don't need to be sold in every store.
No, it's not okay to buy them. No, I look down on anybody who buys a Disney Parks 2011 t-shirt. I'm looking down on them.
I agree with you on that. I personally would not buy one, but that's not my point.
I apologize to any listener who has a Disney Parks 2011 t-shirt on right now.
Because my point is it's not just those t-shirts that are at every single place.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
it's the same stuff everywhere you go. It's the same plush dolls. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's just gotta. We need to get back to that sort of, you know, the spirit of Mombasa Marketplace. We got to get back to that. You know, Disney, the Animal Kingdom has it. It has shops with unique items in there.
And, yeah, the Everstore.
Yep. It has that, and that's what it used to be in all the parks, and that's what it needs to be back at the Magic Kingdom. And I think this is a good start. Just like you're right, maybe if these don't sell very well, maybe they'll, you know, pick it up a bit.
Yeah, I mean, you have the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. They still have a good shop at the end of that ride. And...
Right. Yeah. There's some there. Yeah. It's just it seems like they've left out of the Magic Kingdom for some reason. But anyway, what's next?
Dave, only one more story, and unfortunately, we cannot escape Anna Elsa. First of all, I'd like to apologize to all of the listeners who, after last episode, tweeted me to say how excited they were that Dave was going to be meeting Anna and Elsa, because he's already changed it to Splash Mountain. I will be there with my children, but Dave will be
be on
in his
Splash
laughing
Mountain.
Place. Yeah, like,
place. I'll be at the laughing place. Exactly.
The rampant rumor going around now is that, two things. One is Anna and Elsa might actually be going back to Norway, the pavilion, not the country, to for a meet and greet so that there will be two dedicated Anna and Elsa's. And for whatever reason, I can't figure out the life of me why they ever took them out of Norway and put them in the Magic Kingdom. Why not do both, kind of ease the pressure on, you know, the one meet and greet? But anyway,
I heard they were having serious traffic flow problems in and around Norway as a result of this. Like, people couldn't get to the attraction and stuff like that. And that maybe the stores were suffering as a result. That's what I heard. But I don't know if that's true.
Well, that's definitely true. Okay. It's definitely, I mean, if you saw the...
Well, that's why they did it.
Yeah, but if you had them in two different places, you sort of ease the pressure. What I can't figure out is how come the Akershus restaurant is not being hosted instead of by Belle, which doesn't make any sense, by Anna and Elsa. I mean, why wouldn't they be the people you meet at that particular character breakfast? I mean, that would book up 180 days out or whatever it is.
That's a great idea.
The date was supposed to open. The day you can make a reservation, it would be booked by 7:30 in the morning.
That's a great idea.
Anyway, also the another hot and heavy rumor is that Maelstrom is closing as early as the very end of September for its Frozen redo. Again, this is still a rumor, but it's coming from a lot of different sources. There's still this rumor going around that Disney's basically threatening the country of Norway to give them either $9 million or they're making it Frozen. And apparently Norway has no interest in redoing an attraction to promote a pretend country. I guess as we get closer and closer, the fall, we'll find out for sure. Dave, if I were you, I would make sure I'd ride Maelstrom a couple more times, this up and coming trip, because it might be it.
I plan on it, and I read this too. I read this rumor as well, and I'm hearing it for some. I've heard it from some pretty reliable sources. So I think this is a definite possibility that this is that Maelstrom is going to go away, and we're going to be here with another one of these dopey movie things that are going to last for a couple of years and then going to sit there vacant. So. That's fine. That's what they want. They could sell a little bit extra plush and get people over to Norway. I don't know why we want this, but I don't know why we can't make a Frozen ride in one of the parks, in one of the areas that is for kids and where they can. I mean, you're talking about kids traipsing all the way into the World Showcase to see this Frozen thing, and then there's nothing else in the walkable distance for them to go and see that's really kid-related besides the Three Caballeros. Right? So this doesn't make any sense to me. This belongs in the Hollywood Studios, a park that desperately needs something like this.
For kids.
Exactly.
I don't understand why they just don't plow over Lights, Motors, Action and build an Arendelle. I mean, I've said it, I don't know if I've said it here, but I've certainly said it in other places.
Yep.
You could build like the castle and put a meet and greet in there. You can keep all the crap that they're doing right now at Hollywood Studios, like the sing-along and the ice rink, make it all permanent and part of an Arendelle place, and throw in a dark ride that'll have the kids, you know, the little girls run into the back of that park, you know, on the opposite side of Tower of Terror and Rock and Roller Coaster. And, you know, just, I mean, Hollywood Studios, they complain about how the Hollywood Studios is suffering. That would fix a lot of problems with the Hollywood Studios.
And it belongs there. It doesn't belong here.
Right. It wouldn't make me happy necessarily. I mean, I wouldn't mind it by any means, but that wouldn't fix the Hollywood Studios to me, but it at least would be something.
Is it upsetting to you that I don't know what Arendelle is?
That's the country that the sort of pseudo Scandinavian country that is the realm of Anna and Elsa. That's where they live.
So are we going to change the name of the pavilion from Norway to Arendelle?
If they do that, you could shoot me right in the head. That would be awful.
Is that it for the world news?
That is it for the world news.
All right. On that note, we will take another break and come back with our feature segment. So we head back in time on Radio Harambe. Coming back in just a second.
Never got a tombstone. Oh, my back is sore from lifting up. Big back is sore. Digging, digging,
Welcome back once again to Radio Harambe. It is time for our feature segment. And we are going to, what did I say before? Lock autopilot on the homing signal and head back to the Cretaceous period. But we can't tell you how we're going to do that. That's proprietary.
And didn't take you long to use that joke.
Yeah, talk about dinosaur. That's one of my favorites. Talk about dinosaur. Dinosaur is an original attraction at Disney's Animal Kingdom, opening with the park in April of 98. But of course, way back then, it was called Countdown to Extinction, a name many of us wish Disney had never changed. But alas, in 2000, in what was my opinion one of the worst cross-promotional marketing stunts ever pulled at a Disney park on an attraction, Disney decided to tie the ride more closely in with the computer-animated film called Dinosaur. Now, the film itself actually was pretty successful, though now it kind of seems to be largely forgotten. It was, I would call it, a box office success. And they removed the Countdown to Extinction name and made some small changes, largely aimed at making the ride less scary and more family-friendly. It's a dark ride, part thrill ride, part motion simulator. The ride vehicle moves along a track, but the movement is combined with a range of show elements and vehicle capabilities, helps to create a sensation of faster and more dangerous maneuvers. According to what I've been told, it's built largely on the same template and platform as the Indiana Jones rides in both Disneyland and Tokyo DisneySea. I say that because I've never been on either one of them. Disney has a long and storied history with creating audio animatronic figures of dinosaurs, going all the way back to Walt himself in the 1964 World's Fair. But the dinos found in this attraction are some of the largest AAs ever created by Imagineers. One of them chases your vehicle, clearly taking a page out of Jurassic Park there, but more on that later. Because in just a minute, we're going to turn it over to Safari Mike, who's going to tell us a lot more about the story of Dinosaur. However, before we do that, allow me to issue this warning. It is dark, loud, scares off popular Disney podcasts and podcast hosts, and not always happy and friendly, to say the least. If you have kids that get scared of these sort of things, Dinosaur will have them screaming and hiding their faces. In some places, it is a truly intense experience. Also, the vehicle moves evasively enough to make it kind of physically challenging. So even though it is safe, there are plenty of man-eaters in there. Mike, before I turn it over to you to tell us more about the story, I have a quick question for you.
Sure.
While I was putting together this history of the ride, mm-hmm. it made me wonder, is this the first real kind of modern example, like the test balloon, so to speak, of taking what we all kind of considered a perfectly good ride and molding it into a, basically a cross-marketing campaign to drum up sales of a film and that kind of thing? Can you think of one that was done before that? We're talking about the Frozen one now. We've talked about other ones in the past, you know, putting Jack Sparrow in and stuff like that. Was this the first one that really did that? Yeah, it's a tough one. Think about that for a while. I can't recall before this whether or not they had done that before. And this made this made a big splash when they did do that. It got a lot of people sort of upset.
So you mean taking an older ride and just plussing it, quote unquote plussing it. So you're not talking about like when they put It's Tough to Be a Bug in the Tree of Life several months before the Bugs Life movie came out to sort of promote that kind of thing.
Correct. I mean, that was what was originally there. If they had had a bug movie with all different characters and different names and instead turned around and made them all part of the film, that would mm-hmm. count. So rather than something like the Haunted Mansion where they put in just kind of updated new elements and stuff like mm-hmm. that, I'm thinking more really along the lines of Captain Jack Sparrow, which they put that in there and allowed them to fill the entire souvenir shop full of movie memorabilia, really more than anything else. And that's what happened to Dinosaur. If you remember before Dinosaur was changed from Countdown to Extinction to Dinosaur, there was no sort of movie stuff in there. Then they changed it, and now that's all there was for a year or so, was DVDs in the movie and T-shirts and all that kind of stuff from the film, rather than like cool kind of dinosaur stuff.
And what did you say about the movie? You said it was a box office success?
I think it made money. If I remember correctly, it definitely made money. I think that's how, what you call a success.
Well, I can tell you, I'm looking at Box Office Mojo right now. The its domestic gross was $137 million.
Yeah, but it made in the 400s over all worldwide.
No. $350.
And what did it cost to make? About $130, right?
Correct. Correct. So you add about half of that for advertisement and stuff. So it did make money, for sure.
it wasn't unpopular. It was. I don't think people, you know, it's one of those things everybody went to see because it was like, you know, Mike always talks about Avatar, but how it was a novelty, right? Because it was like a computer animated film, and that was a big thing at the time, and it was kind of very realistic looking, and the facial movements and stuff, and that was a big thing at the time too. So it was, you know, it was a trailblazer in that regard. But I think the quality of the film itself may have not been so well received, certainly not critically.
No, it was critically panned pretty much, and pretty much, I guess, forgotten after a little while.
Right. So anyway, not to get too distracted on that, let's talk about Dinosaur and the story behind it.
Okay. Basically, the story actually sort of starts at Restaurantosaurus, which I'm sure one day we'll cover in great detail. But that was the original Dino Institute. So the whole land, Dinoland USA, kind of the whole land itself is under one story, which is, I think, very unique for a land in Walt Disney World. For example, Adventureland does not have a unifying story throughout the land, or, you know, Frontierland or whatever. So basically you're in Diggs County, which is a fictional county. And of course, Diggs, haha, the pun intended. Exactly. And in 1947, there was this old fishing lodge, which is currently Restaurantosaurus, and some paleontologists happened to be fishing, and they found a T-Rex skeleton, which you'll see reference to it at the Boneyard, again, tying in the whole area.
Right.
So basically, they opened up a dinosaur institute to sort of dig fossils out of the Boneyard, and as that grew and grew over time, the Dino Institute, which the current one opened on April 22nd, 1978, which for Animal Kingdom fans will know that's exactly 20 years before the park opened. So when the Dino Institute that you're currently in, not the Restaurantosaurus version of the Dino Institute, the one that you see is sort of designed in that sort of 70s kind of look to it. It has that kind of office complex, very stark, not very homey looking at all, a very official looking kind of building.
Right.
And the grounds itself around the Dino Institute is very manicured, very utilitarian, not, again, not like the old fishing lodge right down the road, which was the initial sort of Dino Institute and where all the interns who currently work at the Dino Institute reside. But anyway, the Dino Institute itself is supposedly part research facility, as well as a museum for tourists. And and you'll hear Dr. Marsh, who we all know as Felicia Rashad, say, you know, the quaint exhibits. And that's actually the cue. And this is sort of it has the look of a, you know, museum of natural history, where you walk through. The first section of the cue is actually, there are some dinosaur skeletons and whatnot there, but there's also a sort of an emphasis on the animals that lived along with the dinosaurs. You'll see things such as mammals that lived during the time of the dinosaurs.
Birds as well. There are a few there. Yep.
Right. And then when you enter the main hall, which of course has the skeleton in the center, has the meteor up top, and has different fossils all around you, that is sort of that particular room is designed to emphasize what scientists feel could have been the possible causes of the extinction of the dinosaurs. You'll see exhibits on whether or not maybe a disease was what knocked out the dinosaurs, or the rise of the mammals. But they really emphasize what the scientists think was the cause of the extinction of the dinosaurs, and that's of course the giant meteor that's coming down from the top of the wall, from the top of the room.
Right.
And I think Bill Nye, who sometimes narrates little segments while you're waiting, sort of talks about that a little bit. You can also see on the long sides of the walls is a representation of the KT layer, which is this sort of layer of, it's like a thin gray line that's seen in the strata of rock around the world, where it's theorized that it was ash from the meteor collision that occurred however many millions of years ago. And in fact, no dinosaurs are found above that line, while dinosaurs are prevalent below that line. So somewhere in there, for whatever reason, the KT layer shows you when the dinosaurs have gone extinct. Back to the story. the Dino Institute, as you are now entering the building, has innovated a new way to research dinosaurs. And Dr. Helen Marsh, who is the director of the Institute, and is noted to be very recently named the director. And you can see some of the elements of the story by going to a giant board near the boneyard that kind of has these news clippings that, you know, sort of give you the story. And of course, 99.9% of the guests are not going to stand in front of this board reading these little pretend news clippings. Right. But if you do, you will learn that Dr. Marsh has sort of joined forces with a company called Chronotech. Chrono, of course, meaning time. And they've created the Time Rover, which you're going to board, as a way to go back to the Cretaceous and Jurassic period to study the dinosaurs in their natural habitat, just like a biologist would today. Initially, this was used by scientists such as Dr. Seeker, which you'll come to meet in the preview movie, or the pre-show, I should say.
Hello there.
Exactly. But in an effort to raise money, because, you know, research is not free, and certainly, obviously, building these time rovers can't possibly be free, they have now brought in guests, tourists like yourself, to embark on these travels as you go back in time. So that is sort of the story of the Dino Institute and the dinosaur ride.
And I want to mention a couple of things. So you go through the iconic pre-show film.
Mm-hmm.
Which still remains, Mike, one of the best pre-show films. Certainly pre-show areas ever. There's something about it that I, you know, sticks in my head. I
think that's true for a lot of people. I mean, you know, that's proprietary, yeah, below there, and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's so many catchphrases in there that go with it. I love in the, you hear like Bill Nye, the science guy, giving you some information before you're getting in. And the worst thing about that is that, this really is the worst thing about the queue is that it's really good, but most people go right through it. Mm-hmm. The ride almost, moves too well, loads too well. For even when it was busy, you know, you didn't get stuck in that area for very long. You usually got stuck, you know, you got stuck kind of halfway in that area and halfway in the area between the pre-show and the load.
Right. And the load is interesting too, not to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
The load itself, it's very, you go sort of down these stairs into this very industrial looking room. And that's by design. It's supposed to look like a science research facility. They're not going to, you know, they've thrown up a couple of banners that you see, like Welcome to the Dino Institute. And it kind of looks like it's half-ass, but that's on purpose. It's supposed to look like they've just started opening it up to tourists, and they got to raise the money before they put some nice potted plants and some nice graphics up there. And, you know, you'll see like all these wire pipes and things like that. And of course, as many people know, McDonald's was an original sponsor of the Countdown to Extinction, and the chemical formulas for ketchup, mustard, and mayonnaise were printed on those pipes. That's just an interesting thing that a lot of people know. Well, certainly a lot of our new listeners know, but not many of the people who ride the ride would know.
Right, right. So let's talk about the ride itself.
Sure.
You get in the vehicle. The vehicle is what? How many people across? Four or five people across?
Right? Four.
Four? Four people across?
Three rows.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Three or four. Could be three. I'm trying to think of it now. And it is a, like I mentioned before, kind of part motion simulator, but you are actually moving, so you don't have that, you know, that simulator experience.
Mm-hmm.
It is, and you're moving through a dark ride. What I love about the ride is that it could have been real easy for them to show some flashing lights, some meteors, one or two dinosaurs, and tell you the story. But this ride is packed full of dinosaurs. So, I mean, and some of them are really cool.
No, they do. The dinosaurs are pretty cool. I mean, some of them have suffered over the years in terms of malfunctioning. Some of them don't work like they did back in 1998 when I first rode the ride.
Right.
But yes, many of the dinosaurs are cool. It's very dark in spots. And that's by design so that they don't have to really do too much in the way of decorating. So, I mean, if all those lights came on, you would see that it's really pretty sparse.
Right.
But they use lighting or the lack thereof in a certain way to keep it dark, and which is very different from the Indiana Jones ride, which is this is essentially a clone of the track system. The track is exactly the same, apparently. But that's all lit up, but they have to. There's much more detail in that ride.
Yeah, a lot of people tend to compare the two. I'm not really sure why. They're not the same story. They're not the same ride. There's nothing.
Well,
no reason really to compare them other than the technology is the same.
It is the same ride. It's the same track layout.
Right, but it's the same track layout. But it's what does that matter?
I mean, right, that's true. I mean, it's like if they took California Adventure had the same track layout as Expedition Everest, but
a different ride.
Goofy as the
exactly.
The theme or whatever. I mean, I think people would probably still compare it just because it's the same track
system. Yeah, I know why people do it. I just don't think it makes any sense to because they're not really related by any means. I've never been on, like I mentioned in the intro, I've never been on the Indiana Jones rides. I hear they're terrific. I'm a big fan of this one as well. So obviously this is a system that worked. I'm surprised at how they didn't kind of build on this technology over the years and work with sort of a thrill, dark ride, type of thing like this. Because I thought the both of those seemed pretty successful, and that would have been something they would have kind of improved upon or used again as the years went on in this parks,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm trying to think if they really haven't. I guess they really haven't.
No, they really have. At least not in Florida.
Yeah.
I don't know what is in Tokyo or in Europe. They just haven't done it in Florida. So,
good.
So let's talk about what we think of it and our sort of ratings. Before we get into that, I don't want to beat on this too much, but when I first rode this, and it's funny because Michael remember this, him and I and everybody else in that went down there used to have this contest of how many times did you ride it?
Yeah, that's
how many
my
times
fault.
How many times you go on Dinosaur? How many times you go? I went on 8 times. Countdown to Extinction. I went on this many times, right? And it was truly in 1999 a top five in all of Disney World for me.
Mm-hmm.
One of my absolute favorite rides.
Mm-hmm.
Second in the park only to Kilimanjaro Safaris,
okay.
And probably only behind a classic like Pirates of the Caribbean in my mind, from my favorite ride. So it's still great. It's still a ride I tell people to go to. It's still a lot of fun. It gets a lot of sort of flack for reasons I don't really quite understand for people, especially if you've never been on Countdown to Extinction. There's not really any reason to make this complaint that I'm about to make. But what's so frustrating to me is these changes really – the changes that they made really were kind of inexcusable. It was a brand new ride. It worked great. People flocked to it. There was no need to change it. I understand how – you can think over years and years, the Haunted Mansion, you want to make a little tweak to the technology and maybe make it a little bit better. I understand that kind of thing. This didn't need it. It was a year and a half old when they mm-hmm. 2 years old when they made this change. And the change they made kind of dialed it back. So,
Yeah, and they slowed the ride down a little bit. They certainly reduced the noise level.
They made it less, right. They made it more family friendly. And I guess I have to understand that as somebody who doesn't have kids, I guess I should be a little bit more understanding of that. But I certainly don't think Disney lacks in family friendly attractions.
No, but the problem they had at the time was essentially Animal Kingdom had two rides, and one of them scared the hell out of kids. So I mean, when you have Disney, that's a bit of an issue. I mean, it's not like they had 10 other attractions, like it was the Magic Kingdom or something, where they had plenty of dark rides and all that kind of stuff. And if there was one attraction that was really scary for kids, like a Tower of Terror, they could get by.
Tough to be a bug kind of scares the heck out of kids too.
Yeah, that does. this tune. That's true. So there was some scary stuff in there. But the thing is, it's still really not appropriate for little kids. They dialed it back, and it didn't make it all of a sudden great for a 2-year-old. First of all, they saw the height limit, so. Yeah, I think it was a terrible idea myself, too.
That's what I was just going to say, is that the nature of the vehicle itself makes it so that little kids can't go on it, no matter mm-hmm. what you do. So, you know, because of the seat belts and things like that, I mean, they can't do it. So there wasn't really any sense in dialing it back. Who are you appealing to?
Yeah,
you know, a 13-year-old who gets a little afraid, or a 10-year-old? I mean, is that really the reason to sort of dial back a ride's creativity and story mm-hmm. and make it not quite as good as it once was? And even the exterior used to be better. I mean, you know, they plop this dinosaur that looks like a smiling, happy dinosaur, you know, or I shouldn't say smiling, happy. They put essentially a character in front of a building that Mike just explained to you is supposed to be a 1970s government building look.
Right.
It used to have just a fountain out front and a very sort of, you know, natural history museum kind of Triceratops, I think.
It wasn't a Triceratops, but it was a similar, I forget the name of it.
Right, but it was in there, and it fit. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it really doesn't. Now the entrance doesn't really fit the building and the story anymore. And what did you really get out of that? You know, and I just think maybe it's time to go back to the Countdown to Extinction.
And, you know, to be honest, they've kind of have a little bit in that the last time I was on the ride, they've increased the effects a little bit. It made it a little bit noisier. You get the sound of the dino chasing you at one scene. I won't go too much into it. I wish they would go back to getting rid of the dinosaur at the very end and go back to the meteor coming into your face.
You mean the pterodactyl or whatever that is, that's the flying one?
No, at the very end, didn't they used to, instead of having the carnosaur coming at you, they had the meteor because, you know, I'm not, spoiler alert, you're supposed to be right at the very end, right before the meteor hits and you get back just in time. I wish they would go back to some of that stuff. But they have dialed up the effects a little bit. And hopefully they'll keep doing that. And hopefully they go back to the name because, I mean, that was a great name for an attraction.
Yeah, it was. And what Mike's talking about, if you've ridden it before, is people try to remember this. If you, at the very end, there is like a static Carnotaur above you. Right, Mike? That's what you're talking mm-hmm. about?
Right.
And it looks kind of like a statue. Because while all the other... There's dynamics in all the other dinosaurs that you see. Well, most of the other dinosaurs that you see, this one has none. So it just sort of is there, mm-hmm. you know. And he's right; it used to be the meteor coming down on you. Oh man, you jogged my memory on that. I forgot that's what that was back all the way back then.
It made more sense and fit the story.
Yeah, it really did. So I'm hoping they go back to it. But let's, Mike. I know this is still a big one on your list, correct?
Yes, this is very high on my list. I mean, to me, I always associate my honeymoon with Countdown to Extinction. And I know that sounds like a bad pun, but it's really not. you know, we went on our honeymoon in October of 1998, and, you know, we just loved this attraction. And that's where that whole thing started. We actually went on Countdown to Extinction 8 times in 1 week. We just kept going on it. We just absolutely loved it. It was fantastic. So I always associate that particular trip with, you know, the first time we ever saw the Animal Kingdom. It only opened a few months before, and just being enthralled by that attraction, as well as the park in general, the Tree of Life, Kilimanjaro Safaris as well. But I always remember, you know, how many times we rode Countdown to Extinction on that, you know, that 1 week. That and the onion relish from the Flame Tree Barbecue were what stick out in my mind from our honeymoon.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I was saying before. All of a sudden, all of us had to ride it as many times as we possibly could. I mean,
yeah, it was a contest, yeah. Because you went in March of that year.
I went not long after,
people,
right.
Yeah,
not
some other people went later on and all that. So, yeah, I mean, I do love this attraction. It's certainly a top 10 for me in all of Disney World. I like it. I like it more than Expedition Everest myself.
Really?
If I had to go only one of the two, I would probably go on Dinosaur.
What if the Yeti was working?
probably going dinosaur.
Seriously? All right.
I do. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of the ride. I just love the whole air. To me, I just love the whole land. I think it's underappreciated.
Well, that's for sure.
And I love this particular attraction. I think it's great. I love the queue. I know Expedition Everest has a fantastic queue. I get it. But just I love this particular queue. I just love the whole area itself. And I love the attraction. I think it's a great attraction.
Cool. Anything else we want to mention about it before we go?
I don't think so. I mean, I also, by the way, like the store itself as you come out.
Oh, good mention. Yeah, good catch.
It's a good store. It's kind of gone away from being very attraction specific. There's not too many things that they're, you know, countdown or dinosaur or countdown to extinction specific. A few things, but it's, you know, a lot of dinosaur stuff, obviously, a lot of stuff for kids. They have the on-ride photos that, you know, whatever. If you're into that kind of thing, that's fine. But it's a good store for an attraction to spill out into. And I guess that's it. And I like the Cretaceous Trail right by it and just how you have to get to what's the Chester and Hester's. You have that little trail through all the ferns and stuff like that. It's a great area.
Well, that's the neat part about that. Even you were talking about the walkthrough. You have the dinosaur, the big T-Rex, I think, is there. You know, there's some of those dinosaur,
up front, right?
Yeah, some of those dinosaur skeletons there that really sort of set the scene. Cool.
The only thing I wish they would do, and I think we talked about this in a prior show, is sort of build another kind of wing that had like more where you could just walk in and see some fossils and some hands-on kind of natural history museum kind of stuff.
Well, that brings us back to something that is extinct. You know, to the old Dinosaur Jubilee.
Yeah, we could talk about that one day. But
that'll be another item for another day.
But I do wish they would add a little bit, something like that, to the area. Would be a lot of fun.
Oh, I agree. Well, thanks once again for listening to Radio Harambe. Before we let you go, I want to remind you to check out our store, Zazzle.com/Jombo, everyone. There, so you get our Not a Half Day Park t-shirts. People are still getting those. Also, if I told you about our, hope I say this right, Marathi bracelets. Hey, last week I couldn't come up with a name, but this week I could. Marathi is a Swahili word for goal or project, and our very own Brooke, fellow writer at JomboEveryone.com, has made some of these great bracelets. They're kind of like animal-inspired. She's donating all the proceeds from these to our conservation partners. You can learn about them by going to the blog, JomboEveryone.com. You'll see the bracelet picture actually on your right. Mm-hmm. Click there. It'll tell you everything. You can also catch her on Twitter, or you can email me at JomboEveryone@gmail.com. They're $18. Shipping is in the continental United States is included, correct?
Correct. And you get to pick which of our conservation partners you would like to donate that money to. Well, we have 5. Go on the website, check them out, donate to them anyway. But, right. You know, if you purchase one, you will be able to pick where the proceeds go.
Awesome. And if you do want to make donations, go to our website. As I mentioned before, JomboEveryone.com. Click the conservation tab at the top. It'll tell you all the conservation partners that we're donating any money that we make from all these sales to. You can find all the information out there. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Radio Harambe, and I have actually been on Twitter the last few days.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, how about that? Safari Mike is forever at JomboEveryone.com. Never seems to be off it. We're also on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Pinterest. You can find all those links at JomboEveryone.com. So, for Safari Mike, I'm Dave McBride. Kwaharini, go well, and thank you for listening to Radio Harambe. Now, Ata melele, amita. Kwaku walufa melako, na kungu.